Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being extremely serious. This episode is rated a 5. In the summer of 2012, 24-year-old nursing student Megan Sharpton was standing at the edge of a bright future. Just months away from graduation, she was eager to step into the career that she had always wanted, one where she could care for others and put her compassion to work as a nurse. So when the chance for a potential job interview came along, she leapt at the opportunity to jumpstart that career. But instead of opening the door to the life she had worked so hard for, that so-called opportunity led her somewhere far darker. What awaited her was not a new beginning, it was a terrifying tragedy. This episode is titled The Fake Interview. So without further ado, let's get started. July 2nd, 2012, a couple driving down a rural road in Franklin County, Tennessee, near the city of Tullahoma, saw something that forced them to pull over. It was a fire, and their initial thoughts were to try and put it out so it didn't spread. But as they got out of their car and started walking toward it, they were in for a startling discovery. What they thought was burning brush or debris on the side of the road was actually a human body, and it was engulfed in flames. The couple, beside themselves, quickly called 911 to report what they had just found. Soon after, first responders arrived to the scene and extinguished the fire, as investigators with the Franklin County Sheriff's Office began piecing together what had just been discovered on this otherwise ordinary stretch of road. After speaking with the couple who had stumbled upon such a traumatic scene, investigators quickly determined that this couple was just at the wrong place at the wrong time by happenstance, and they did not know the victim. The couple also informed police that they had not seen or heard anyone around upon their arrival, so it was obvious to police that the couple had nothing to do with whatever was happening here. The immediate problem for investigators working the scene, though, was that they couldn't identify the victim. There was no purse or cell phone or ID, not even a car or vehicle around to help identify who this person was. All they could gather was that this deceased person was a white female, likely in her 20s. She had little star tattoos behind each ear, as well as a magnolia leaf tattoo. She was wearing a nursing school shirt, but she was undressed from the waist down. And by the time first responders arrived, her body was partially burned and covered in soot. However, police noted that the fire was mostly relegated to her pelvic area, which led them to believe that the victim had been sexually assaulted, and whoever did it literally tried to burn the evidence. According to an episode of a docuseries titled An Unexpected Killer, the young woman's body was already in rigor, so investigators believe that she was most likely deceased before the fire was started. And although they'd have to wait until the medical examiner could perform an autopsy for the official cause of death, the victim appeared to have blunt force trauma to her head because investigators said they could actually feel the broken bones in her skull. With no way to know who the victim was, investigators turned to social media and put out what information they had in effort to identify the victim. Within only a few hours, investigators received a call from a woman, Kelly Sharpton, who saw their missing persons report online. She had been at work, and when she read the description of the young woman who had star tattoos behind her ears, Kelly screamed out in the middle of her office. That description, it sounded like her daughter. After speaking with the Franklin County Sheriff's Office, Kelly agreed to go to the station in Tullahoma for a formal interview, where Kelly's worst nightmare became a reality. Detective George Dyer explained, quote, "When we interviewed Kelly, she was distraught. She was crying, and she identified the body on pictures. The victim was her daughter, Megan Sharpton," end quote. It wasn't long before Megan's older sister, Carrie Taylor, joined their mother at the police station. Carrie recalled, quote, "I walked in and I immediately heard my mom sobbing, and I can still hear her to this day. She just said, 'Somebody killed her last night.' And it took me a second to figure out what she had just said, and then it hit me that she was gone. I was very much in shock that day. It didn't sink in that somebody killed her. It was just very, very hard to process," end quote. Upon identifying the victim as 24-year-old Megan Sharpton, investigators with the Franklin County Sheriff's Office began piecing together a timeline of her last known movements. According to the episode of An Unexpected Killer, Megan's sister Carrie last spoke to her the day before at about 4 or 5 p.m. on Sunday, July 1st. Carrie explained that the family would normally go to their mom's house for dinner on Sundays, but that particular Sunday was different. Carrie recalled that Megan had said she needed to miss dinner because she had a last-minute job interview, but Megan also said that she might stop by their mom's house after the interview was over. However, the evening went by and Megan never showed up. Carrie said, quote, "Later that night, she wasn't there. It wasn't a concern for us. We all thought, okay, well, something else must have come up. She was on her own time, and we'll see her sometime tomorrow," end quote. You see, Megan had a full, busy life. Working her way through nursing school at the technical school in Shelbyville, she was about 2 months shy of graduating, and she was ecstatic about it. Carrie described her younger sister as a bright young woman with a big heart. Carrie said, quote, "She was genuine. She was the most compassionate, caring, captivating person I've ever met. Regardless of who you were, where you were from, she didn't care. She really, truly cared for every single person," end quote. So it was obvious that Megan was making the perfect career choice. During this time in her life, Megan was also living with her boyfriend, 25-year-old Chris Farrell, in an apartment that they shared together. According to the episode of An Unexpected Killer, Megan and Chris had met because they were part of the same friend group, and they had been dating for the past 3 to 4 years. Carrie said, quote, "She was in a very good place in her life. She had lots of goals to go on to those next levels in school and her career," end quote. During their interview at the Franklin County Sheriff's Office, Carrie and her mom, Kelly, provided police with a description of Megan's car. She drove a red or burgundy-colored 1995 Mustang, so the police put out a BOLO, or a be on the lookout, for Megan's vehicle. While they were waiting for results of the BOLO, or waiting for something to come back, police began looking at potential suspects who might have a motive to harm Megan. And Carrie wasted no time in pointing the finger at Chris because she said that that was the only thing that made sense to her at the time. Chris was the only person who was with Megan on a daily basis. Carrie explained, quote, "He asked me, 'Why do you think Chris did it?' I thought Chris and Megan had an up and down relationship. They were like oil and water. They would be hot-headed and tempered at times," end quote. Brittany Bailey, Megan's best friend, also shed light on Megan's and Chris's relationship. She said, quote, "Once Megan and Chris got together, they were inseparable. But towards the end of Megan's life, the relationship had started growing apart at that point," end quote. Naturally, police wanted to speak to Chris because in cases like these, the suspect is usually someone who knows the victim. But before they were able to reach out to Chris, investigators got a tip and located Megan's car. It had been only 12 hours since Megan's body had been found. According to the reporting of Wayne Thomas for the Tullahoma News, her car was left abandoned off a rural road in a neighboring county, an area between Tullahoma and Shelbyville. It was approximately 15 to 20 miles away from where Megan's body had been found off Awalt Road in Franklin County. Investigators working the case said the car was a bit cluttered, but they found no personal items inside. What they did find, however, was an odd handwritten note which included directions to an address. But police quickly noted that the address written down was non-existent, like it was a fictitious place. So they began to wonder if perhaps someone lured Megan to that fake location. Following the discovery of Megan's abandoned car, investigators sealed it off and sent the Mustang to the crime lab for further testing. But while they waited for the results, their next move was to talk to Chris, Megan's boyfriend, so they headed to the apartment that the two shared. Todd Hindman, another detective working the case, said Chris was the first potential suspect they looked at. Detective Hindman explained Chris's demeanor when they first met with him. Hindman said, quote, "He was distraught. On the night of the murder, Chris had told us that he had left for work, and she had told him before he left she had accepted a job by phone, that a girl she had went to school with recommended her for this job, and that she would return in the morning. And in fact, she did not return, and he became worried, and he had reached out to her mother," end quote. But investigators followed up on what Carrie had shared with them, and they asked Chris if he and Megan had been having any problems in the relationship. Detective George Dyer recalled, quote, "Chris described him and Megan's relationship as a good relationship, that they had their ups and downs like anybody else, but that he would never hurt Megan," end quote. While Chris seemed genuine and believable during this initial questioning, investigators were still suspicious of Chris and wondered if he might be hiding something. So they asked him to go to the station for further questioning in a formal interview, and Chris agreed. Once there, Chris opened up more and said he and Megan's relationship had been a bit strained. He said he felt like she wanted him to have a better job and be more career-driven than he was, especially since she was about to graduate college and start her career in nursing. So it was almost as if they were in different places in their lives. She was ready to start working and settle down, while he still wanted to be young and free. Still, though, Chris swore he would never hurt Megan, and he also provided an alibi to the detectives. He told them he was at work at a local department store where he worked a shift from 5 p.m. to midnight. While they seemed to believe Chris, investigators still needed to confirm his alibi and wait on Megan's autopsy to determine a specific time of death before he could officially be crossed off the suspect list. However, during their interview with Chris, they learned that there was actually a third roommate who lived in the apartment with them. The roommate was one of Chris's friends, a guy named Robbie Rosar. So naturally, police wanted to speak with this guy too, so they brought him in for questioning. Detective Hindman said, quote, "Robbie was a different person. Robbie was a little darker, a little less happy person," end quote. During the interview, they asked him outright where he was when Megan was murdered, and although he didn't have a solid alibi, he showed them that he had been texting Megan all through the night and even into the next morning because he had been worried about her when she wasn't responding to texts or calls. He was also adamant that he would never hurt Megan and that he was not the person responsible for her murder. Detective Hindman said, quote, "He wanted to prove his innocence, which is a good indication for me that he didn't do this," end quote. But here's the kicker. When they asked Robbie about the nature of his relationship with Megan, his answer left them completely stunned. Y'all, he proceeded to tell them that he and Megan had been in a romantic relationship and that Megan had planned on breaking up with Chris. Now, while this was a shocking turn of events for investigators working the case, it wasn't news to Megan's best friend, Brittany. Brittany said, quote, "Megan had told me a few weeks before her murder that her and Robbie had started to develop more of a relationship versus just friends," end quote. But Franklin County detectives looked at this news as a potential motive for murder. If Chris had found out about Megan's and Robbie's relationship, it might just be the driving force to kill someone. So they went back to Chris and dropped this bombshell of news on him to see how he would react. But y'all, they soon learned that Chris had no idea his friend and his girlfriend were seeing each other behind his back. And though Chris was visibly upset when he found out, he maintained that he still loved her and that he'd never hurt her. And the police believed him. According to the episode of An Unexpected Killer, both Chris and Robbie took polygraphs as well, and they both passed with flying colors. So they both moved down the suspect list, and investigators shifted their focus. Next, they started looking into the supposed job offer from the night Megan was killed. Chris had informed police that he thought the job offer or interview opportunity came from a classmate who Megan had gone to nursing school with. But Chris only remembered the girl's first name as Naomi. So investigators looked through school records and discovered Megan did in fact have a classmate named Naomi Jones. Their next move then was to pay Naomi a visit. Detective Heineman explained how the situation went down. He said, quote, "I went to Naomi's residence. I knocked on the door, nobody there. I drug out my lawn chair and I sat in the front and I'm going to wait. I'm going to get this statement today. A neighbor kept looking over there like, who is this crazy guy? And I was like, you know, I need to talk to Naomi Jones," end quote. Heineman went on to say that the neighbor knew the Joneses well enough that he called Naomi and Detective Heineman was able to speak to her on the phone right then. He said, quote, "In talking to Naomi, I said, hey, you know, I'm Todd Heineman. I'm with the Franklin County Sheriff's Office. I'm investigating the death of Megan Sharpton," end quote. Heineman recalled that Naomi said she did know Megan, but she made it a point to tell him that they weren't close, that they just went to school together. She said they had ridden to nursing clinicals together once and that her husband had driven them. But something peculiar Detective Heineman noted was that Naomi didn't seem to care for Megan for whatever reason. In fact, Naomi even told him that she wouldn't recommend Megan for anything and she denied any knowledge of any job offer, let alone Megan's death.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, per prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
While police were considering their next move, Megan's autopsy report from the medical examiner was released. Her official cause of death? A gunshot wound to the face and blunt force trauma. Detective Heineman explained that because of all the soot on her upper body, the gunshot wound was somewhat hidden when they first arrived to the scene. According to the medical examiner, Megan was shot with a .22 caliber pistol and her skull was broken in several places. So it was possible that she had been beaten with the pistol and then shot. What they knew for certain, though, was that she was deceased at the time of the fire, which was set at 1:18 a.m. on July 2nd. Her time of death, then, was determined to likely be before midnight on July 1st. And just like investigators had originally suspected, there was evidence of a sexual assault because DNA was present in her body, which was collected and rushed to the crime lab for analysis. While they were waiting for those results, just 2 days after Megan's death on July 4th, police got another lead. A man fishing in a nearby creek discovered some of Megan's belongings. He had found her purse and driver's license as well as her social security card, but what wasn't found was her cell phone. So investigators ordered her phone records and waited. As we know, murder investigations take time, and it wasn't until about 3 weeks later that Franklin County detectives received the results of the forensic search of Megan's car. But the problem was, there were no results to work with, as in, there was no additional evidence found inside her car. So, they continued waiting on both the cell phone records and the results from the DNA that was collected during Megan's autopsy. Meanwhile, police circled back around to Chris's alibi, which checked out. Surveillance video showed him working as a cashier in the department store during the time Megan was killed. However, Chris did contact police with a lead that sent them in yet another new direction. Detective Heineman explained, quote, The original phone call about this job opportunity came into an older phone that Megan had. He was able to go back and find a number that he believed had called proposing this job. End quote. But when police ran the number, it yielded zero results because it was a burner phone. The good news for investigators, though, was that the full picture of what happened to Megan was starting to form. They now had a burner phone, a fake address, and a suspicious job opportunity. So, it was growing more and more apparent to them that whoever killed Megan not only knew her, but also lured her out to assault and kill her. After this, investigators tracked the phone to being sold at a local department store, where they began checking video surveillance from the time frame that the phone was likely sold. As they were combing through the footage, they specifically looked for males who seemed suspicious or stood out to them in some way. And lo and behold, they found what they were looking for. One guy in particular caught Detective Heinemann's attention because as he was checking out and paying for the burner, he had another phone in his hand right there at the counter. Heinemann explained, quote, "He's already got a cell phone. He's buying this burner phone for a reason. We were able to use the video from the department store to follow him from the purchase out the door into the parking lot. Almost off camera, we saw him approach a red pickup truck. Why would you park that far out unless you were trying to avoid detection?" End quote. So investigators used the surveillance photos of this suspicious man and circulated them to other nearby police departments. Within a matter of minutes, they got a positive identification. It was a man by the name of Timothy Gifford. According to the episode of An Unexpected Killer, Gifford was a local drug dealer, so investigators in Franklin County felt like they were definitely on the right track, and they believed that Gifford was either the guy, or at the very least, he was involved and knew something. Upon identifying him, investigators tracked Gifford down and took him to the station for an interview, during which they flat out told him that they believed he was the killer and that the DNA from the crime lab would prove it. Gifford pushed back, though, and adamantly denied the crime. But what he did know? Well, he sang like a bird. Gifford told police that he did not know Megan, and he denied ever speaking to her. The burner phone, on the other hand, well, he said he bought it about a month before the murder for someone else. A man named Donnie Jones. When that came out of Gifford's mouth, police were familiar with him. Apparently, Jones had a rap sheet about a mile long, including thefts and drugs, and he had definitely served time before. Y'all, he had even been previously accused of rape. Anyway, if you're like me, the last name of Jones definitely stood out to you because, wasn't that Naomi's last name? And sure enough, investigators quickly found out that Donnie Jones was married to Naomi Jones, a person they had already spoken to. Apparently, after further digging, investigators found out that Donnie actually drove Naomi and Megan to school more than just once. He'd actually driven them on days when the weather was bad and they didn't feel safe to drive themselves. Regarding this discovery, Detective Dyer said, quote, "There was a lot of aha moments in this case, but that was, we're going somewhere. We've got something here," end quote. Oh, and that red truck that Gifford was driving when he bought the burner phone for Donnie Jones? Well, police also discovered that it was actually Donnie's truck. In fact, Gifford informed them that just a few days after the murder, Donnie replaced the entire interior of the truck, including the carpet, and he had it detailed just in time to trade the truck to his brother only a week after Megan was murdered. Detective Heinemann said, quote, "Everything is pointing toward Donnie Jones. As quick as we could, we got a search warrant and we took the truck directly to the TBI crime lab," end quote. Immediately after that, they headed straight to Donnie's house to get some answers. When they arrived and first started talking to Donnie, he initially denied everything and said he hardly knew her. Then he said, quote, "No, I take that back. When my old lady was going to school, one day they both needed a ride," end quote. But he swore up and down that he had nothing to do with the murder. His alibi, on the other hand, was flimsy at best. He said he was home with the kids all day. They had a 9-year-old and 7-year-old twins, and that kept him busy. Of course, investigators weren't really buying it, so they confronted him with all of Gifford's claims. In response, Donnie invited them to search his house, and obviously they did just that. Surprisingly, though, it didn't yield many results, like at all. However, Donnie also provided a DNA sample right then and there and let him swab his cheek, which was exactly what investigators were hoping for. Now, while they waited for the DNA results to come back, they received their forensic results from the red truck they had sent to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Detective Hindman explained, quote, "The truck had been cleaned, almost sanitized. Even the interior parts that I gathered off the search warrant, they didn't come back with any evidentiary value," end quote. But luckily, they still had his DNA. All they had to do was wait for the results. And just 4 weeks after Megan's murder, those results came back. It was a positive match. The DNA from Megan's autopsy matched the DNA of Donnie Frank Jones. When investigators brought Donnie Jones back in and confronted him with the DNA results, he continued to deny. So Detective Hindman just straight up asked him, "Why would your DNA be inside of her then?" And Donnie became enraged. Franklin County Sheriff Tim Fuller recalled, quote, "He got very, very, very irate, mad. After he had a moment, Donnie said, 'I just had sex with her,'" end quote. But hold on, this was the same man who had originally claimed he barely knew her and hadn't even spoken to her. Now his story had shifted completely. Still, the district attorney told investigators that they needed more than just an inconsistent statement. At that point, the only thing they could reasonably confirm was that he'd admitted to having sex with her, and even that couldn't be proven as non-consensual. Without stronger evidence, the Franklin County Sheriff's Office had no choice. The DA couldn't prosecute, which meant Donnie Jones walked free, for now. The last piece of the puzzle for this case was cell phone data. If they could prove that Donnie was in the same place as Megan through the GPS data on their cell phones, they could prove Donnie was with her all night. So they ran a detailed search on 4 different phones. Megan's, Donnie's personal cell phone, Timothy Gifford's cell phone, and the burner phone that Gifford purchased for Donnie. Detective Hindman explained how GPS analysis works. He said, quote, "They can take technical data and plot it out on a map and show you, to some certainty, an area where a phone call was made," end quote. However, this is the part of the investigation that can take weeks or even months to collect and analyze. Detective Hindman said, quote, "We're in kind of a waiting period, hoping for phone records for the silver bullet to put this thing away," end quote. While they were waiting, though, they found a way to get Donnie off the street. You see, they discovered a rifle in the trunk of his car. No, it wasn't the murder weapon, but because he was a convicted felon, he wasn't allowed to carry or possess a firearm, which meant they were able to arrest him and hold him on a $100,000 bond, a bond he was not able to pay, so he sat in jail. In November of 2012, 4 months after Megan Sharpton was murdered, the Franklin County Sheriff's Office received the results of the GPS data analysis. And lo and behold, it was the smoking gun they needed. Detective Hindman broke down the results. He explained, quote, "On the night of the murder, the burner phone, I'll refer to it as the murder phone, and Donnie's phone, they were in or about the same location. Timmy's phone is not involved. The murder phone and Megan's phone are talking to one another, and the cell phone records will show they were coming in contact with one another, and then they both stop where her car was found, and I think at that time was when she was abducted," end quote. According to an unexpected killer, the cell phone data confirmed that Donnie was close to both the place where he abducted her and the place where he killed her and burned the body. Also, while they were waiting for these results, police discovered that Donnie has family who owns several farms in the areas where the crime took place, which were all very secluded. And after approaching the family allowed investigators to search the areas in question, which yielded even more solid evidence. In one location, they found a burn barrel as well as a purple scarf with little black stars. When they showed that scarf to Carrie, Megan's sister, she confirmed that she had given that scarf to Megan as a gift. So it was official. They had their guy and they had all the evidence they needed to prove it. Detective Heineman said, quote, "It went from an absolute whodunit to this guy might have done it to, oh, this guy definitely done it," end quote. Following these new discoveries, the DA moved forward with an indictment, and on November 5th, 2012, Donnie Jones was charged with first-degree murder, rape, and two counts of aggravated kidnapping. So what exactly happened on the night of July 1st and into the early morning hours of July 2nd, 2012? Well, here's what police theorize. According to Detective Heineman, they started backtracking all of the numbers that the murder phone had called, and they found a pattern. Heineman explained, quote, "Everyone that was called with that phone was someone that was sitting with the elderly or doing some kind of nursing in-home service. The murder phone was used just seeking out a victim. Donnie had reached out to Megan. He knew well enough to go on his wife's phone and get her number out, and that's how all this started. Megan was on her way to a job that didn't exist," end quote. You see, he sent her directions to a fake address, which is where police believe he met her and abducted her. He then took her back to one of his family's farms, where he raped, beat, and shot Megan before moving her body to a new location and setting it on fire. Detective Dyer said, quote, "Megan Sharpton's last few minutes of life was pure hell and panic and fear. Donnie Jones is just a cold-blooded killer. Sexual deviant, cold-blooded killer," end quote. 7 months after Megan's murder, on February 4th, 2013, Donnie Jones pleaded guilty and was sentenced to life without parole. He is still currently serving his sentence. But Megan's friends and family said no amount of time in prison will ever be enough to justify Megan's terrifying death. Brittany, her best friend, said, quote, "I feel like there will never be enough done to him. He's sick. He's a monster. There is no reasonable explanation why he did it," end quote. In the midst of their sorrow and mourning, Megan's loved ones did experience a glimmer of light in early November 2012, right before Donnie was indicted and charged. The Tullahoma News reported that the Tennessee Technology Center in Shelbyville awarded Megan a posthumous degree and presented it to her family during the fall commencement ceremony. Her 18 classmates said graduation wasn't the same without her, although they felt her there in spirit. In her honor, the students decorated an empty seat and played a tribute slideshow during the graduation. Kelly, Megan's mom, told the Tullahoma News how hard Megan worked for that degree. Heartbreakingly, she said, quote, "She wanted to be a nurse and she was on her way before her life was stolen," end quote. Now, this story wouldn't be complete if I didn't share with you that the family once again experienced a tragic loss. About a year after the graduation, in November 2013, Kelly Sharpton died by suicide. Carrie sorrowfully explained, quote, "Her heart was just incredibly broken, and she made the choice. She wanted to be with Megan," end quote. Erica Megan Sharpton was born on October 24, 1987 in Tullahoma, Tennessee, and she was described as the world's brightest star with a caring, compassionate soul. Carrie said, quote, "She and I were really, really, really close. She had the best laugh. She was so fun. I miss that laugh. If you just heard Meg's laugh, you would be having a much better day," end quote. Megan's best friend Brittany also reflected on their time together. She said, quote, "I thought Megan and I would be friends for, you know, on into adulthood. We were supposed to be together forever as best friends, as sidekicks. She was not someone you could forget," end quote. In her honor, Megan's family placed a memorial on the side of the road where she was found. So if you're ever driving down Awalt Road in Franklin County, Tennessee, near Tullahoma, you will see a large, beautiful star sculpture which perfectly reflects Megan to her core. Okay, y'all, that brings us to the end of Chronicle 102. As always, be sure to check out my social media where I post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. Okay, well, that's all for today, so bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. campus crony Alexis McDonald is my research assistant. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.